It's lovely to see that roof on the shrine. It's been in the basement for years. And first time I came to Croydon, I'd moved to Rivendell in the autumn of 93. The Mitts were on the team in those days. And I did come up to Croydon occasionally, usually for festivals. And the shrine room was upstairs where the yoga studio is in those days. This is the Hockney's restaurant on this floor. And that's what they had on the shrine. And then a few years ago, it seemed to disappear in the basement. So I just love it. It's got, having done a bit of sculpture, it was done by a woman who's now in Norfolk, not involved, but you get a sense that she's really picked up the essence of the standing Buddha in that figure. It's very feminine as well, which is fine. But I'm going to talk about the boss. Sorry. I always call him the boss behind his back. My meetings with him, informal and formal. I'm looking around the shop earlier on. I saw this image, this card, and it's the snows of Kathmandjunga. And of course, when Sangharakshita, long before he came back to England, he lived in Kalimpong, and that was his view. And he's written a beautiful poem about the snows on Kathmandjunga. So, yeah. So, where to start? Well, I've done a mind map, so gives me a prompt anyway. He did say, Sangharakshita, I'll call him Bansi, which is what people generally refer to him as. It only means teacher in the Buddhist tradition. So there'll be Theravadan Bantis, there'll be all sorts of Bantis, so that it's not just one Banti, it just means teacher. He did say many years ago, if you really want to know him, you've got to read his poetry. If you really want to understand him, you've got to read his poetry. And the good news for you is that if you want to do it, you can download it free from his own website. His books, including two of his poetry books, which are out of print, you can download them for free on PDF files, including the big thick volume that was published in 1995. It's the year I was ordained. So what I want to do is start with a poem. And this poem was written when he lived in Kalimpong, and it might give you a sense of how Sangharakshita is in the world. He considers himself a poet. I mean, I don't like all his poems, but this one, you get a sense of what he was seeing, particularly in Kalimpong. It's a very strong poem. And it's called The Bodhisattva's Reply. What will you say to those whose lives spring up between custom and circumstance, as weeds between wet stones, whose lives corruptly flower, warped from the beautiful refuse and sediment, their means of sustenance? What will you say to them? That woman, night after night, must sell her body for bread. This boy with well-oiled hair and the innocence dead in his face must lubricate the obscene bodies of gross old men, and both must be merry all day, for thinking would make them mad. What will you say to them? Those dull-eyed men must tend machines till they become machines, or till they are cogs in the giant wheel of industry, producing clothes that cannot wear, and the cellophane luxury goods they can never hope to buy. What will you say to them? Of these dim shadows which through the pale-glowed tropic dawn, from the outcast village, flit, balancing on their heads baskets to bear away garbage and excrement, hugging the wall for fear of the scorn of their fellow men. What will you say to them? and wasted lives that litter the streets of modern cities, souls like butt ends tossed in the gutter and trampled on, human refuse dumped at the crossroads where civilization and civilization meet, to breed the unbeautiful, what will you say to them? I shall say nothing, but only folding compassion's arms, their frailty till it becomes strong with my strength, their limbs bright with my beauty, their souls with my wisdom luminous, or till I have become like them, a seed between wet stones of custom and circumstance. So that's Sangharakshita, the poet, but also the man of compassion, and the man who has very much always been connected with humanity, whether it was in India, particularly with the ex-untouchables, or Dalits as they prefer to be called these days. And for us, when he came back to England or London, first in 64 and then in 66 permanently. So he has always been connected with humanity. And Alec was saying he wants to go meet him. So I would encourage anybody that wants to go meet him, go up pretty soon, because he's coming up to his 90 and he's pretty frail. I didn't meet him, but I glimpsed him recently, and he is a walking skeleton. And he was walking with his walking stick. He can't see very much now. So my first meeting with him was in December. Get the year right. 91. And he lived at the time in his very small flat, and I would kid you not, it was very small, in Sakavati, which is the London Buddhist Centre. And there is a couple of communities over the London Buddhist Centre, and he had a flat which is now an office. And I just asked for ordination. In those days, traditionally, you wrote to Sangharakshita and the ordination team, you wrote to both of them. And I'd got involved in the Birmingham Buddhist Centre where I was living, Birmingham. So I went down, and somebody said to me in Birmingham, he really likes Indian sweets, as in the dessert. So not far from where the centre was, there was a shop, an Indian sweet shop called Sona. And Sona actually became my preceptor couple of years later. And so I've got a little box of sweets to take with me. And I also had one volume, I'd inherited a 12-volume set of Dr. Samuel Johnson's works. And I decided to give him all 12 volumes, but rather than lug the all 12 volumes down to London, I'd arranged for an order member to get them to him. And I just took one with me, so I had the sweets, and I had the book with me. And on Roman Road, I bought a bunch of flowers. So I arrived in my appointed time, quite nervous, and Paramartha, who again is his companion, let me in, and I saw Sangharakshita first time. I handed in the flowers and the sweets and the book. He just put the flowers down on the table, put the sweets down, and completely ignored them. I'm not sure whether he ever said thank you. And then he got hold of Dr. Johnson's volume of Dr. Johnson's book. He opened it. The 1923 edition. It's now in the Adistana Library, the whole lot. So I'm quite pleased with that. But I can't remember much about my very nervous first visit. I think I managed to last 45 minutes. Possibly not. One didn't. Even order members couldn't hack it very long with him unless they really knew him. And at that time, I had been a civil engineer. I specialised in highways. So he asked me what I did, and I said I was a highway engineer. Oh, no, I call myself a road engineer. I didn't think he'd know what a highway engineer was. So he said, that's very useful. And that's all he said. So I think a year later, I was talking to Subhuti. And I met Subhuti just after that time because he was a head of the ordination team at the time, and I'd sent a card to them. And again, I was in Sakavati, but I was staying overnight there. I was my work had changed a bit. I was doing expert witness, and I work and going to the courts and so on as an expert highway witness. And I used to stay in communities and give them the hotel money for my expenses. And Subhuti was staying there, and somebody said who I was, so he came and shook my hand. And I mentioned to Subhuti either on that occasion or later on that Banti had said that a road engineer would be useful. Subhuti said, "Oh no, he wants the track up the Secret Valley paved." It's never been paved, thank goodness. So yes, that was my first meeting. He's welcoming, but if he picks up that you want something from him, some acknowledgement, something from him, he just senses it. And that's why he put the flowers down and the sweets. He just didn't want them. I was wanting thanks. I was wanting something from him. And he's got an uncanny sense, even with order members, if they're wanting something from him, he just doesn't give it them. So it's my neediness. So the second meeting, So in the autumn of 92, I became a Mitra guest at Badjaloka, the retreat centre in Wales, and I was there for 3 months. And when I came back, my room was still on the top floor of the community. And shortly after I came back, Sangharachita was playing his first visit to the Birmingham Centre. It's not the same Birmingham Centre as now, it's a much bigger building now. They've moved from that building, but that building is still a community. So he'd been given my room, which was the best room in the house in terms of, I like having good rooms. So he was sleeping in my bed, but A, it meant I couldn't have the use of the room, so I was sleeping on the living room floor downstairs on a mattress. And his companion, again, Paramartha in those days, he was borrowing my books on my bookshelves, and I gave him one at the end of the visit. It's only for a few days, but I'd just been offered the opportunity of moving to Rivendell as a Mitra and a team of three order members plus me. But also had been offered the opportunity to work for Windhorse Publications, who were moving to Birmingham. So I didn't know what to do, whether to stay in Birmingham, work for Publications, or move to Rivendell. So when I went up to see Banti, it was a procession of people had appointments with him in my room. So I went up and I said I had this conundrum. Were to go, and I just was looking for guidance, and he said, "I don't really know you, Robert. I can't give you an advice." That was it. End of it. I wanted him to make the decision for me, and he wasn't playing ball with it at all. He just picked up on it. So he just said, "I don't know you well enough." So that's that one. You might get a sense of how he is in the world. He's very, particularly with when he gets some neediness, you're picking up on neediness. When I did move to Croydon, to Brivendell, it was really good for me. And there was one occasion that was a woman, Mitra, who was not involved here. She does classes in East Grinstead. I can't remember her name. But she organised a Desert Island Disc evening here, or might have been a Saturday morning. Must have been an evening, because I would have been busy on the Saturday at Rivendell. And so with Desert Island Disc, if you know the programme, there's usually 10 questions. And so that was, she fielded the questions. So we were in this, by this time, the Shrine Room, I think, was downstairs here. And So that's right, there were a lot of chairs out. It's come back to me visually now. So yeah, he was good, and he was answering all these questions, very informal, and let them know which piece of music was his favourite music, so that was played as well. So it was very interesting that to have that other side of Sangharakshita, to what he was interested in from those questions. We'd all had to field questions if we were interested. And in that, I got ordained, as I say, in 95. And no, this is another one first, forget that for the moment. I wasn't ordained in 95. And I had a flat in Birmingham before I moved into the community, and I'd been letting it out. And I decided to sell it. It never picked up its price from my buying it years before, 10 years, it sat at the same price. So the man you might have met, Surya Kato, and he was a used to be called Mark, and he first came to Croydon on Saturday morning, and he used to then come to a class we had at Tunbridge Wells, and he got ordained, and he runs a Tunbridge group, Surya Kato. So he came up to Birmingham with me. I hired a van to move the furniture out of this flat so it could be sold. And what I arranged for him was his first meeting with Sangharakshita, and I didn't tell him. So when we'd finished loading the van, I said, "Oh, we've got something else we need to do. Well, you better have a proper wash. I've got somewhere around the corner to take you to." So Sangharakshita was living at Madjumaloka in Birmingham in those days. And so I took him round, and it wasn't till we got to the door, I said, "Oh, by the way, you're going to meet Sangharakshita." He said, "What?" So he went in, and so he went into Baptist's flat, which is at the side. And oh, that's right. Now, I think he saw him in the conservatory, that's right, which is downstairs. And then Surya Kato came out, and he gave me his digital camera. He said, "I want you to take a photograph of Sangharakshita and myself." So I said, "Oh, yes, if you've asked him, okay." So I was led into the conservatory to give the photograph of Mark, as he then was, and Banti. Completely unabashed, Mark puts his arm around Sangharakshita. I had never, ever, and I've still never seen anybody do that. They hold him, they prop him up while he's walking now, but I've never seen anybody put an arm around him like a mace. I took the photograph twice, and I said, "Good God, you took a risk." He said, "It was fine, I asked him beforehand." So there's a warmth that when Surya Kato is the most authentic person I know. When he first came involved, and Dhamma Vijaya saw it as well, there was something about his innocence and authenticity that's absolutely amazing. He'd never read any books till he read a Dharma book. He'd grown up as a biker, reading comics. So when he published his first Dharma book, that's the first book he'd ever read. So that gives you a sense of the naivety and the authenticity that arises from that naivety. So moving on a bit, after I was ordained, as I said, in 95, I found myself and my sins, one of the organisers on the order convention up in Wyndham, which is in Norfolk, which is a local authority boarding school for sixth formers. Very big, it's the only place that can hold the conventions. So it was one Saturday morning, I'd been asked to get a lot more flowers from the local town. So my pal Abhaya Badger, who was ordained with me, he and I were rushing off to car park to go and drive to the local town. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw Sangharakshita with another companion, which is a Saturday morning. Everybody else is in the shrine room doing something or other, just after breakfast. And he was walking very purposely towards me. So I said to Bhaivaj, hang on, slow down, we've been spotted. So he walked right up to me and he said, how's your health, Ratna Chudo? I said, it's fine, Bansi, now. I'd had ME for a number of years, and that's why I'd left Rivendell in summer of 98. I had colitis, then ME. And he knew. So we're moving on to, this was in 91. On 93, when he walked up to me, he remembered, and he just, so there's something very, he remembers people, he had no real contact with him, but he remembered that I'd been ill, and that's what he wanted to know about. So there's a kindness in him, and then he went off, got back in the car, got in the car with the Bhaivaj, and said, there's something else happening. He was giving us a teaching, slow down, just be more mindful. We were rushing about, back to rush off and drive off, so I drove very carefully to the local town. The other one was a strange sort of meeting. I had an older member friend who used to live in Sheffield, lived in several places, and at the Sheffield Buddhist Centre now have the place in an old Catholic convent. It's a huge place, but this time I'm talking about, it was a much smaller centre they had. And they'd invited Sangharakshita up for a question and answer session. And I was staying with my friend, and he said, oh, well, you picked lucky. Sangharakshita's going to come tonight to the centre, so come along. So I did. And there were a few questions he was fielding, but I had one that had been puzzling me for a number of years. I don't know whether any of you know the long-dead French photographer, used to be a photographer of Paris Match, Cartier-Bresson. I love his photographs. And he's the only photographer that managed to record the independence celebrations in India in 48. He went from Paris Match. And that was the time Gandhi was assassinated as well. And so he had long lenses. Most of his photographs he's famous for was cafe scenes in Paris. And he always used Leicas, old-fashioned Leicas. And it was rather cute. He had a lens made by Leica, and it was a right-angle lens. So he'd be holding his camera at you, but actually it was the lens was pointing there, and that, so he was taking a photograph of that person. So it was in these small intimate cafes, so he looked as though he was looking at you, but it was actually taking a photograph. So I was curious what Sangharakshita's view of that, because he never asked people could he take a photograph of them. That's what makes his photographs so magic. So I asked Sangharakshita what he thought, he knew Cartier-Bresson's work, and he said he didn't agree with that approach to photography. If you want to take a photograph of somebody, you should ask their permission. So I said, well, actually I don't see it the same way. I just stood my ground and said, I don't see it, because the world has benefited from those very intimate magic photographs of Cartier-Bresson. I saw an exhibition of his photo. I've seen two exhibitions. One I bumped into in France years ago, of the Indian photographs. They're absolutely stunning. So I didn't agree with him on that occasion. So moving on from me, being a highway engineer, it's sort of my career disappeared from me. And I became a counsellor psychotherapist. And I did a lot of voluntary counselling with crews, first of all in Brighton, and then I did a lot of voluntary counselling with hospices, particularly Trinity Hospice on Clapham Common. So I got them far more from doing the voluntary counselling than I was paid to be a counsellor, therapist. But I became an expert, I considered, in grief and bereavement. And knowing the Parinirvana Sutta, the last few months of the Buddha's life, pretty well, I mean, there's some amazing things in that sutta. If you remember, the thing that's always trotted out is Ananda, his companion for 20-odd years, and his friend, when he realises the Buddha is dying, he goes away and he's weeping like mad. And the Buddha has to ask Ananda to be brought to him, and he said, I'm paraphrasing, haven't I told you all things are impermanent, everything passes away, sort of thing. But what Ananda said was that, not about the Buddha's teaching, about the kindness of the Buddha, he that had been so kind to him. So there's a lot of magic in that sutta, and I really love it. So there are other things the Buddha has said, and there are other things in Buddha. So I wanted to do a PhD on grief and bereavement in Buddhism from a Buddhist perspective. So I was enrolled at Leeds Met University for my sins. I was hoping to get a grant for that, but I didn't get one, so I was going up there. And I finished up with a Reverend Christian professor as my supervisor. He didn't understand where I was coming from, but there we are. As somebody said to me, Leeds Met isn't a proper university, he isn't a proper professor. And he was a proper professor that said that to me. So I thought, right, I'll start at the top. So I arranged an interview with Sangharakshita. So I went up a year before and went through the interview, preliminary of it. So he knew what, so he had time to think about it when I was going to go up for the interview. And so I went along with two tape recorders. I was giving myself some redundancy. There's not going to be no second chance with this one. So I took two tape recorders and I'd made a mind map, a structure of what I wanted to do. And I had a brilliant interview with him because I was fascinated. There is a book of his in the library called Through Buddhist Eyes. That's the last volume of his memoirs he's ever going to write. And what's interesting about that particular book, it was Terry Delamere, who was a good friend of his, round about the time Sangharakshita was forming the beginning to found this movement. Terry Delamere was a very disturbed young man. He writes quite a lot about Terry Delamere. They went off to Greece together in Terry Delamere's motor caravan, drove all the way down through Italy and so on. So he's very close. They weren't living together. But Sangharakshita was living up in North London. Think the name of the tube station. It's not Kelsall Green, but it's North London. And he got a knock on the door one day. It's all in Buddhist eyes, this. And it was the police. Terry Delamere had thrown himself underneath the tube train. So what Sangharakshita writes in the book, Through Buddhist Eyes, he cried every day for 6 months. And he wrote an incredible poem. So I wanted to bring that all into the interview because nobody else had actually asked him all about it. He'd written about it, but I wanted to actually ask him from the outside. But I did a lot of homework using that book. And I had all the quotes from his book, and I quoted them back to him from his time in India. And the Terry Delamere, and it really took him into a very different space because I was using the words that he had written. I just read them out to him and took him back to it. And there was another thing I brought up with him, was that when he, if you know anything about his first volume of memoirs, You know, as a young man, he was conscripted just 2 years before the war, Second World War ended, at 18, and he went to a training camp somewhere in Surrey. And he got a phone call from his father to say the house had been damaged by a German flying bomb. So he came, presumably came in his uniform. And what was extraordinary, because I knew this story very well, so I mentioned it. And he was just sitting there in front of me in his room in Birmingham. And he went right back into this experience. He said he walked up this road and he said it had a curve in it. So he couldn't see the house at first. And then he saw his father standing at the gate and his father's bicycle. I don't think the bicycle is mentioned in the memoirs as far as I remember. And as he walked up this road, he began to see some damage to houses on this side of the road, slates off, windows broken and so on. But as he went more around the curve, he could see his house was completely demolished, first floor, demolished. His father was just standing there. And so I just listened to this account, which I knew so well. And I said, I think you rescued some of your old books and papers, didn't you? He said, yes, I was a bit naughty. I scrambled up the rickety stairs and found a few things. Then I went down to the ground floor and got a few more. He said, I was a bit naughty. It was dangerous. It was like a little imp talking to me. You know, it was an 18, 19-year-old boy, man. And then he said something extraordinary to me. He said, it's 60 years ago, and it's as fresh in my mind as if it was yesterday. I knew there was something different about him. He'd actually been in that experience, which says something quite extraordinary to me about what the nature of memory is. I don't have an answer for it. Some of his memories are very, very, very vivid. And I would also say some of his memories are a bit conditioned as well. And he chooses not to memorize some things, as a lot of us do. But it was just extraordinary being with him in that interview. I interviewed Subhuti. Banti actually recommended Subhuti have an interview with me as well on that series. So I did Subhuti and then Suchamani as well. Which is quite a different one, another order member. I've not done anything with them because I moved the PhD to SOAS and I gave up after a while and decided, heck with academia. I might produce some sort of book from it one day. I've given up thoughts of that most of the time. So, mentioning that through Buddhist eyes, again, there's another way of getting to know Sangharakshita, and that's through his memoirs. There's 5 volumes of memoirs. Whenever I go to Guyaloka, I usually have a long solitary there. I'm going in September for 4 weeks, a bit shorter this time. I always get the volumes of his memoirs, one or two volumes of his memoirs, because there's a library up there. I don't have to take them. And I always read something that connects me with him. So as well as getting other things, books from the library. So Through Buddhist Eyes is the last one, a really magic one. It doesn't deal much with the founding of the movement. It was only just beginning, and so his autobiography sort of finishes there, and others will have to write the rest of it, probably when he's dead. He's quite consciously done that. But his Manjubhadra, you had Manjubhadra last Saturday. He was talking about his travels with Sangharakshita in America, I think. Through Buddhist Eyes, he mentions a lot of those travel episodes. So there's a lot of travel log in those as well. So well worth reading. And with all due respect to my good friend Manjubhadra, Sangharakshita can write and Manjubhadra can't. I do have a question though about Sangharakshita's connection with the world, because if you read very, very carefully, as I have done several times, you begin to see another side of him which I'm not wild about. If a cafe is noisy or hasn't got his food, or he's visiting somewhere in Greece or somewhere, and there's a lot of people around, they're almost an irritant to him. The trips in Spain he was doing through Buddhist eyes, he was wanting to go there and everywhere. But something about humanity sort of gets lost somewhere, because he's so focused in seeing this church or that church, and he's done a lot of research and he knows exactly what he wants to see. So I do have a criticism, whereas I love being in the world. I've been writing stories, so I carry a little black notebook with me all the time. So things I see on the streets, even pigeons, I've written a story about two pigeons having a conversation about climate change. Oh no, that's a dinosaur story. The pigeons are talking about immigrants having a conversation. It just came because I saw some white pigeons on Ipswich Station last year. Suddenly had the idea. So I have probably a more down-to-earth connection with life in the world. So the next meeting was a non-meeting. I ordained, let's say, in 95. And I was down, Guhyoloka is a very steep valley. It was bought in 86, so it's a very steep valley with steep cliffs, particularly limestone cliffs on this side, and limestone on this side, but big, big cliff. Like big elephants that side, more limestone this side. The retreat centre is up here somewhere. So I was down at the bottom of the valley, and I realised it was late afternoon, we were having a puja. So the men wear robes when they're ordained, unlike the women, for whatever reason, I don't know. So I was in my robes, I'd been down there, I realised it was late. So I start, instead of going up the track below this limestone cliff, I took a shortcut through the pine woods. There's lots of tracks. And I crashed into his bungalow. Sangharakshita wasn't on my ordination retreat, but he was having his usual break there for the summer. And he and Paramartha was his companion again those days. And I crashed through, and Paramartha just roared with laughter, and I said, "Oh, sorry, Banthi. I disturbed the peace of the afternoon." So I climbed back onto the track and got back up to the retreat centre. But a couple of days later, I was wandering down the track, managing to be as quiet as possible this time. And you can look down on the bungalow where he doesn't go to anymore. The community that live there use it now. And he was in the garden, in his deck chair, and he had his straw hat on. It was really hot that summer. And he just had his feet stretched out in front of him, and I was on the track, about 50 feet above him, something in metres anyway. And I just stood and looked at him. And I was just sitting there, he wasn't asleep. I thought, I could learn from you. Doing nothing. You're doing nothing. And I criticised this movement, Sri Ratna movement. I was talking with an order member, a good friend of mine, yesterday at the Tate. We're a movement and an order of activity. It started, Sangharakshita was used to be very active when he started. Subhuti was being very active, still is in India. But very few order members sit and do nothing. And very few mitras, very few people sit and do nothing. And I've got a PhD in doing nothing. I've got to become an expert in it. I just do nothing after breakfast. And I try to do that as much as possible. That's where the reflections and the insight arises, out of doing nothing, not formally sitting in meditation, thinking about impermanence. I didn't have to throw up the word impermanence. I just start thinking of it. I watched the scene. This older man that I was with yesterday, he's been ordained longer than me. He said he was worried. He's been in a wheelchair for 30 odd years, so getting around is not as easy as it is for the rest of us. But he said he was in Ipswich. He went down to the waterfront and he was just sitting there on his own, having a break from being the chair of Ipswich. And he said he was just watching the water lapping. And suddenly the insight of impermanence rose. You know, movement, everything moves, everything's in process. So that's where you can, even if you sit in a park doing nothing, just look at the leaves changing, the flowers changing colour and aroma. Seasons are brilliant. It's pouring down with rain yesterday. What's it doing today? Pouring down with rain tomorrow. Impermanence staring us in the face. So Sangharakshita's teaching on doing nothing was just magic to me. It's something I've forgotten about that Birmingham visit. Another teaching that he didn't realise he was giving some of us. The day he was leaving my room upstairs, thank goodness I'm getting my room back, he came down the stairs to get in the car outside, and he walked. Right? He could walk quite well in those days. So carefully, precisely down the stairs. I thought, right, and out to the car. Now, how many people do you see walking purposely, mindfully, with awareness of what's around them? It's what's in Buddhism the elephant walk. Sangharakshita has written a lot about elephants, how they go through the jungle very, very purposely. And an elephant doesn't have neck muscles, so if an elephant wants to look over there, it will have to turn its whole body round. It doesn't do what I do. So they have to take everything in, whether it's in front or at the side, with complete awareness. So that's why Sangharakshita was going downstairs very carefully, very purposely. And that's the other teaching, and we talked about it after he'd driven off. I said, he's given us a teaching by just watching him come down the stairs. So yeah, I've just remembered that one. So those are my last meetings. So what's my connection with him? Well, I have for a long time considered myself a disciple of Sangharakshita, and I'm very, very grateful for that, because he has introduced all of us to the Dharma. So I consider him my teacher. I'm a follower, if you do take to his teachings, which is all that a discipleship means, a follower. But in the last few years, I've become very much a disciple of somebody that's long since dead. He died in the 13th century, a Japanese Pure Land Buddhist, Shinran, who Sangharakshita has read Shinran, and Shinran is on the refuge tree of this order. So he's still very much part of this movement. So I have gone through, what's my connection with Sangharakshita? It's still very much a follower and full of gratitude, but as a Pure Land practitioner, I'm not the only Pure Land practitioner in the order, but very few of us, I think four or five of us worldwide, have come out of the closet, as it were. But that's fine, I'm comfortable with that. So the other aspect of him that I gather being mentioned here is I'm not unquestioning over some of his past behaviour, which is still around on the web, particularly the sexual encounters. And I think this is where his memory has been convenient at times. And my preceptor Sona, who knew nothing about all that going on, he's not unquestioning. Nor is Subhuti. I've talked to Subhuti about it, and he's challenged Sangharakshita and got nowhere with him. I think my main, as an ex-psychotherapist, my main question is the naive young men. So it's more of an ethical issue for me rather than the actual sexual thing, which is. that was what he was doing, so that was what he was doing. It was just these very naive young men. So I'm not unquestioning as a disciple, but I'm still very, very grateful to him. And I'll miss him when he goes, any day now or whenever it is. He's a pretty frail 90-year-old. I was at a retreat at Adistana where he lives. I was on a writer's retreat, and a couple of mornings when it was fine, he was out walking in front of Adistana with his walking stick. He can't hardly see. He can see to walk, but he can't see to read. He's not been able to see to read for years. There was one time years ago when he was at Padmaloka, the men's retreat centre. I was sleeping on the ground floor. I was after an eye operation, so I wasn't in one of the dorms. And he was in the next room. There's a bathroom on the ground floor. And he came out of the bathroom, bumped into him almost face to face. I said, "I'm sorry, Banty." He said, "I know the voice. I can't see you though. He's peering like this at me." So that's how bad his eyesight has been for years. Close work. It's macular degeneration. So he uses talking books, and he has books read to him. So I don't think I can say much more. I can't say any more. But if there's any questions, I'm happy to do that. Oh, yeah, I do want to say a couple of things. I picked these up. It's lovely. They're still selling this. It's one of the first books I bought. It's ancient, this guy. He's now ordained, but it was Chris Pauling when they published it so many times. It's such a simple book on Buddhism. It's lovely to see it. And Sangharakshita's book, Living Wisely. That's quite amazing. Guide to the Buddhist Path. I just found them, picked them up. That's me. Anyway, I'm willing to take questions if you've got any questions, or I'll be outside for a while.